conjured the mist and driving rain as a kind of cloth, spectral, to screen him from the shapes of his own recent past. Moody did not linger. He turned and hurried up the beach, past the slaughterhouses, the latrines, the breakwind huts along the sandy lip of the shore, the tents that sagged under the greying weight of 2 weeks' rain. His head was down, his case clutched tightly against him, and he saw none of it. Not the stockyards, not the high gables of the warehouses, not the mullioned windows of the offices along Wharf Street, behind which shapeless bodies moved through lighted rooms. Moody struggled on, shin-deep in slurry, and when the sham front of the Crown Hotel rose up before him, he dashed towards it and threw down his case to wrench with both hands at the door. The Crown was an establishment of the serviceable, unadorned sort, recommended only by its proximity to the quay. If this feature was an expedience, however, it could hardly be called a virtue. Here, so close to the stockyards, the bloody smell of slaughter intermingled with the sour, briny smell of the sea, putting one in mind perpetually of an untended icebox in which an uncured joint has spoiled. For this reason, Moody might have disdained the place offhand, resolving instead to venture northward up Revel Street, to where the fronts of the hotels broadened, brightened in colour, acquired porticos, and communicated, with their high windows and their delicate fretwork, all those reassurances of wealth and comfort to which he was accustomed as a man of means. But Moody had left all discerning faculties in the pitching belly of the bark Godspeed. He wanted only shelter and solitude. The calm of the empty foyer, once he had closed the door behind him, muting the sound of the rain, had an immediate and physical effect upon him. We have noted that Moody derived considerable personal benefit from his appearance, and that this was a fact of which he was wholly sensible. He was not about to make his first acquaintance in an unfamiliar town looking like a haunted man. He struck the water from his hat, ran a hand through his hair, stamped his feet to stop his knees from shaking, and worked his mouth in a vigorous way as if testing its elasticity. He performed these motions swiftly and without embarrassment. By the time the maid appeared, he had arranged his face into its habitual expression of benign indifference, and was examining the dovetailed join at the corner of the front desk. The maid was a dull-seeming girl with colourless hair and teeth as yellow as her skin. She recited the terms of board and lodging, relieved Moody of 10 shillings, these she dropped with a sullen clatter into a locked drawer beneath the desk, and wearily led him upstairs. He was conscious of the trail of rainwater he left behind him, and the sizable puddle he'd created on the foyer floor, and pressed a sixpence upon her. She took it pityingly and made to leave, but then at once seemed to wish she had been kinder. She flushed, and after a moment's pause suggested that he might like a supper tray brought up from the kitchens. "To dry out your insides," she said, and pulled back her lips in a yellow smile. The Crown Hotel was lately built, and still retained the dusty, honeyed trace of fresh-planed lumber, the walls still beading gems of sap along each groove, the hearth still clean of ash and staining. Moody's room was furnished very approximately, as in a pantomime where a large and lavish household is conjured by a single chair. The bolster was thin upon the mattress, and padded with what felt like twists of muslin. The blankets were slightly too large, so that their edges pooled on the floor, giving the bed a rather shrunken aspect, huddled as it was beneath the rough slope of the eave. The bareness lent the place a spectral, unfinished quality that might have been disquieting had the prospect through the buckled glass been of a different street and a different age, but to Moody the emptiness was like a balm. He stowed his sodden case on the whatnot beside his bed, wrung and dried his clothes as best he could, drank off a pot of tea, ate 4 slices of dark-grained bread with ham, and after peering through the window to the impenetrable wash of the street, resolved to defer his business in town until the morning. The maid had left yesterday's newspaper beneath the teapot. How thin it was for a sixpenny broadsheet! Moody smiled as he took it up. He had a fondness for cheap news, and was amused to see that the town's most alluring dancer also advertised her services as the town's most discreet accoucheuse. A whole column of the paper was devoted to missing prospectors. If this should reach the eyes of Emery Staines, or any who know of his whereabouts. And an entire page to barmaids wanted. Moody read the document twice over, including the shipping notices, the advertisements for lodging and small fare, and several very dull campaign speeches printed in full. He found that he was disappointed. The West Coast Times read like a parish gazette. But what had he expected? That a goldfield would be an exotic phantasm made of glitter and promise? That the diggers would be notorious and sly, every man a murderer, every man a thief? Moody folded the paper slowly. His line of thinking had returned him to the Godspeed and to the bloody casket in her hold, and his heart began to pound again. "That's enough," he said aloud, and immediately felt foolish. He stood and tossed the folded paper aside. In any case, he thought, the daylight was fading, and he disliked reading in the dusk. Quitting his room, he returned downstairs. He found the maid sequestered in the alcove beneath the stairs, scrubbing at a pair of riding boots with blacking, and inquired of her if there was a parlour in which he might spend the evening. His voyage had wrought considerable strain in him, and he was in sore need of a glass of brandy and a quiet place to rest his eyes. The maid was more obliging now. Her sixpences must be few and far between, Moody thought, which could be useful later if he needed her. She explained that the parlour of the Crown had been reserved that night for a private party.
"The Catholic Friendlies," she clarified, grinning again.
But she might conduct him instead, if he wished it, to the smoking room. Moody returned to the present with a jolt, and saw that Thomas Balfour was still looking at him with an expression of intrigued expectation upon his face.
"I beg your pardon," Moody said in confusion. "I believe I must have drifted off into my own thoughts for a moment."
"What were you thinking of?" said Balfour.
What had he been thinking of? Only the cravat. The Silver Hand, that name, gasped out of the darkness. The scene was like a small world, Moody thought, possessed of its own dimensions. Any amount of ordinary time could pass when his mind was straying there. There was this large world of rolling time and shifting spaces, and that small, stilled world of horror and unease. They fit inside each other, a sphere within a sphere. How strange that Balfour had been watching him, that real time had been passing, revolving around him all